today I would like to refer to the historical background of liberation theology and giving some information on the history of Latin America, and then in the next days developing some other aspects of today's liberation theology in Latin America. Before doing so, though, I would like to ask your help. I'm very glad to be here at Holden Village. I've spent a year in St. Paul, Minnesota, teaching at Luther Northwestern Seminary, but this is an occasion of meeting people of various backgrounds, not only candidates for a future ministry in the clergy ministry in the church, but meeting people of different denominations and both clergy and lay people. So, and being from Brazil and not from the United States, I would like to ask you to help me at this first session in giving me some feedback already now on what associations come to your mind when listening to the term liberation theology. I understand that some of you might have already read some books on liberation theology and got some information from Latin America. Others might not, and I would encourage especially those who have not had that contact with reading of liberation theology also to participate of this first moment, giving me some ideas of what passes through your mind when you listen to the term liberation theology. What do you think that could be about? What implications do you see? What connotations come to your mind? But of course, all those who have already read some are also welcome to give me some impressions so that I also can relate better to whatever your expectations and your level of information is at this point. So, okay, that's I would like to ask you for your cooperation right at the beginning of giving some ideas of what liberation theology, what do you associate with that term, what do you expect around themes of liberation theology. Yes, please.
Yes, the thing that always comes to mind is the ongoing debate between people of various faiths and, that as to whether or not Christians should be involved in working towards liberation of oppressed people, or whether or not the work of Christians is to evangelize and so forth. And that's what always comes to mind when I think about it.
Thank you. So that's the relation of evangelization and social, political commitment and struggle for social change. And some other, yes, please.
There's a common fear that it's Marxist land.
Mm-hmm. Question of Marxism and liberation theology, Marxist orientation, yes. Thank you.
And the possible conflict, I say possible, between traditional theology, not least of all Lutheran, mm-hmm. and liberation theology.
Okay. Traditional theology and a new approach to theology now, is there a conflict? And
not the overall Protestantism and Reformed theology. Possible conflict.
Okay.
Listen, for some people it is.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Yes, please, over there.
The question of means being used and whether or not violence is a permissible means to obtain society.
Okay, thank you. Question of means for changing society, and is violence permissible? Okay, up there.
Can we know Christ in our affluence? And
okay.
Struggle free. lifestyle?
Can we know Christ in our affluence? So you assume already that in lack of affluence we can.
But isn't the flip side of that, God is on the side of the poor?
God and the poor, yes, okay. Flip side. Okay, some more? I think it's a good brainstorming already, yes? Okay. Well, either one.
I think of liberation theology as a theology of the people, rather mm-hmm. than of the theologians or great thinkers, or however we look at those people.
Okay. Liberation theology as a theology of the people and not as much by distinguished theologians. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I've often wondered if that stemmed from base communities, if liberation theology came from base communities.
Okay. Base communities, so that concept, please.
Maybe what this says is why, when I used to hear talks about liberation theology in my church, I never really could kind of understand it. It seemed sort of voice, and it wasn't until experiencing, just in a very limited way, a base Christian community that started kind of making sense. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, a lecture on it or something was real difficult to understand.
Yes, well, that's a comment I've heard of many people, that when just reading books or listening to lectures is a little bit difficult to understand liberation theology. And once you've got the exposure of being in a base community in Latin America, Central America, it starts to make sense. So I understand that possibly some of you have had that kind of exposure, but others not. So we have to deal a little bit with that difficulty, but let's try to do the best. I think we have a little bit of a liberating experience right here, so, okay.
Maybe it's because I don't understand. Part of me is very sympathetic. Part of me feels like there's a lot of this, but there's some part of me that there's a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. Raise the term, and I feel this confusion and sort of not understanding, and something that's very a little reticent to just get into it, and some fear. I don't know, my gullibility. I don't know what it is, but there's something that's there still.
Okay, thank you for this comment. I think this is very often so, and possibly with all of us to some extent. That kind of struggle within ourselves of sympathy and fear of possible implications of all this, and is that to be faithful to Christ and the gospel or not, and so on. These questions I think are very important. Yes, please.
The only theologian I read is Dom Helder Kammerer, and every time I read him I felt, oh, I've never thought about it that way before. So many fresh insights. Such a creative mind.
Okay. It's good to have that name of Archbishop Elder Kammerer falling here. I think it's a very important figure in Latin America. Yes.
I have a friend that I had this ongoing dialogue with that, because it seems to me one of the points of liberation theology is that it's contextual theology, and he says, well, that's bad theology. You need a theology that transcends context. And if there is such a thing, I don't think I believe that, but to him, there is such a thing out there.
Okay, how do we relate theology with context? If it is a contextual theology, is it therefore false, or and only the theology that, as you say, transcends, is beyond the context can be a true theology? I think it's a question we have to deal with. Liberation theology is, of course, very much a contextual theology, but also wants to transcend context, so possibly in a different way than those who criticize it think it should be. Well, okay, just a couple more comments.
I guess one of the things that I think about is a sort of a concern as to whether or not there is a lot of theology in the liberation, or whether that's just true for a few people, and that a vast number of people are simply after liberation. And you see that in other places besides Central America. You see that in, say, Israel with the Zionists naming a Israeli state in the name of the Old Testament, and then there's a whole lot of people who aren't even believers who are looking toward their own needs. Mm-hmm.
Okay, is their theology really there, or it's just the name of theology, but might just as well disappear and say no theology, just liberation, and what would it then be, and what is the sense of talking of theology of liberation? Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. I think that was a very fruitful brainstorming, and that gives me a good idea of the questions you have in mind, and don't hesitate to bring new ones. Some of these I think we'll have opportunity in some later sessions. I myself won't be able to address all of those now, especially because for this session I was intending to speak to the history of Latin America and trying to help you to understand as best as I can how liberation theology has developed, or what is the place out of which we have to understand liberation theology in Latin America. So a few of the points which you have risen, possibly we will be touching already today to some extent, and others possibly more in the coming days, as much as you, I don't know whether you would be coming the other days, but just to make a little bit of propaganda for the next session. let me, you have a world map here. I think it gives you an idea of Latin America, and if you have the United States or the 48 states here, you can see all of this Latin America, and you can expect a great diversity in such a huge continent, really. If you take just Brazil from where I come from, that's a little bit bigger than the 48 states in itself, and that's just half of South America, and then you still have Central America and Mexico. So when we talk about Latin America, that's really a huge continent, and very often we don't see the diversity of it. At the same time, it is correct to use the more general term of Latin America, and I will do so myself because there are so many common points in Latin America, and probably I will be talking more to those. Nevertheless, I wanted to point out that there is also great diversity in all aspects, geography, history, political systems, social systems, and so on. But there are also some common features, and that is important to take notice of. Well, if we are going to put very briefly some main dates, let me put here 1492, then more or less 1810, and then ? 1959-79. I will come back to each one of those, but talk more about the original period in Latin American history, starting in 1492. Of course, if I say starting in 1492, I'm already taking the point of view of those who came into this continent and claimed to discover it, while there were millions of people living already in this continent. But nevertheless, my critical remark, you noticed it already, let's start with 1492. So Columbus came, and just in a few years we will be celebrating. How will we celebrate it? The 500th anniversary of this discovery. Of course, as I mentioned, that's a euphemism. It's the point of view of the Europeans and those who are descendants of Europeans, as the vast majority, if not all of us here now, who look to this history and say it was discovered, this continent. In reality, it was a history of a conquest of a continent. There were populations living in throughout the Americas, and they lived here for thousands of years before that. Nevertheless, we talk about the discovery of it. When Cortes, Hernan Cortes, conquered the Aztec Empire in Mexico, 1521, then reached the capital of the Aztec Empire, Tenochtitlan, that was at that time the biggest city in the world. And, well, we don't have the time to tell now the details how he could conquer fairly easily that big empire and the biggest city in the world at that time, but just to mention that that was the biggest city in the world and a highly developed cultural and civilization. If you have the chance of going to the Anthropological Museum in Mexico City, you can see in a small scale rebuilt that city of Tenochtitlan, and it was an impressive city of great beauty. And that city was almost completely destroyed. Only a few small ruins are left today. And at the very site where there was the central temple of the Aztec Empire, which was then destroyed, on that place was built the big Catholic Christian Cathedral as a symbol of reconquering that domain for Christ. I will come back to the concept of reconquest a little bit later. Well, jumping over many aspects of our history, I have to say that probably around 90 million Indians died on the Americas, out of the military conquest, out of the contact with the white populations, out of disease and so on. In some cases, Indian populations not willing to accept the dominancy of the white populations coming in, even committed collective suicide in despair. But anyhow, summing up, the estimates go run up to 90 million Indians that died in this process. So this is a continent stained with blood, which was shed in the along this process. If you move on, then many Indians were enslaved in today's Latin America, but that system for several reasons didn't work as well as the new system which developed then, which was bringing blacks from Africa. And again, probably about 10 million blacks were brought from the African continent to the Americas, about 40% of those 3.5 million blacks to today's Brazil. But that's just about half, or at the best, two-thirds of the blacks that were taken out of Africa, because at least one third of the blacks would die on the voyage from Africa to the Americas. So again, a history of suffering being inflicted to other people and populations that then had to live on this continent as slaves. Well, the typical colonial system which was established, I will exemplify that in the case of Brazil, was of granting the king of Portugal or of Spain would grant huge portions of land to a certain person who would then be in charge of organizing an expedition and try to go over there and exploit as much resources as possible. So if you roughly take the, well, let's see if this is a little bit, you take roughly this, the Brazilian coast, what the king of Portugal, for example, did, it just drew kind of horizontal lines like this and granted one piece like this, huge, bigger than some of your states today, to one person who was then in charge of it, would organize an expedition, probably pay another person, and soldiers or people would be taken out of prison to come to this area, try to exploit the natural resources, wood or minerals, and gold, silver, stain, and so on. Or when agriculture was developed, it was then a type of monoculture of those products that were necessary in Europe. Sugar, for example, later cotton, and later coffee, and so on. Or if you look into the parts of Latin America that were colonized by the Spaniards, that was from the very beginning, first the mineral resources, gold. One of the mistakes that the Montezuma, the emperor of the Aztec Empire, made was that when Hernan Cortes came to the coast of Mexico, he sent as a greeting, as a sign of hospitality, he sent a gift of gold to Cortes, which of course only attracted much more his greed. And so Mexico, and then along today's Peru and Bolivia on the Pacific coast of South America, there were these mineral resources which were exploited. So the typical colonial system was try to exploit as much as possible the natural resources, or when agriculture, also goods which were necessary at the metropolis, so in Spain and Portugal. Spain and Portugal, on their turn, had received finances from Central Europe to finance the huge expeditions. So much of these resources never stayed in Spain and Portugal, but moved on to Central Europe, and were one of the important bases for the economic development then in Central Europe towards future capitalism. So the natural resources of this continent moved to Europe, and there provided the basis for the economic development of Europe. Well, then if you move on to 1810, that's the next date I put there. That's about the time when the Latin American countries became politically independent. And that is a political independency, but not a real economic dependency. Actually, it represented a shift in economic dependencies. The United States had declared its own independence from England some years before that date. And so England was trying to look for some other place where to have a basis for its own economic interests and industrial development, which was going on in England. So they left, England kind of left the United States because of the independence here and tried to move in a different way into Latin America. And it was a very appropriate time to do so, because right at the beginning of the 19th century, the Iberic Peninsula was threatened by Napoleon, and then Napoleon really entered Spain and Portugal. And the Royal House of Portugal, for example, moved in 1808, fleeing from Napoleon, to Brazil. And Brazil became, for a few years, the center of the Portuguese Empire. And who supported the Portuguese Royal House, for example, was England. And so immediately Brazil, and then also the rest of Latin America, opened the ports for trade with England. And what happened is that England was now interested in placing the goods of the Industrial Revolution, and was not interested again that in Latin America own production of those goods would rise, but was interested in buying meat, for example, from Latin America. So again, the pattern of economy was a sense that Latin America was supposed to continue to produce natural resources, basic goods, which would be necessary for Europe in exchange for those consumption goods which the Industrial Revolution was producing in Europe. This is a basic difference from the political independency of the Latin American countries to the one you had in the United States, and it's very important for you to realize that. When you cut the relations with England, these relations were established into Latin America and not cut by the political independence in Latin America. Well, time is running. Let me just say that some people today ask the question, or postulate perhaps even the hypothesis, that with a Cuban revolution in 59 or with the Nicaraguan revolution in 79, a new stage in the history of Latin America could be in the beginning, new stage which would put more stress on the internal necessities of Latin America rather than in the necessities of abroad. But I leave it as with a question mark for the time being, at least just make that remark now as a possibility of what some people say. I do want to move to the church and say a few things about the role of Christianity in this whole process. And would like to bring to your attention two Spanish words. And one would be Padruado, and the other one would be Cristiandad. Well, let me say that the crown and the cross went hand in hand into Latin America. And it was a a project which combined both aspects, the political and economic aspect of the conquest and colonization, and the evangelization and Christianization of Latin America in one single system. And this project is called Cristiandad, which means Christendom, but as much as I can feel the English language, the Spanish word says much more than the English word of Christendom implies. Because Cristiandad is really a project for the entire society. And to understand the internal move in that, I would like to call the attention that the Iberic Peninsula, Portugal and Spain, had been occupied by Arab populations and dominancy during almost 8 centuries. And during those 8 centuries, a typical mystic developed in the Iberic Peninsula, a mystic very much centered in suffering and the cross of Christ, which will have developments in even today into liberation theology, the role of suffering in Latin America. So 8 centuries of occupation of the Iberic Peninsula by Arabs, Muslims, and also at that time a great desire of what we could call today liberation of the Iberic Peninsula developed. So against those non-Christians, the struggle of the peoples in Spain and Portugal to liberate themselves from this occupation. And that process was called the Reconquest, reconquering the Iberic Peninsula. And 1492, precisely on that year when Columbus came to Latin America,
there was Tarsus, Spaniard in the today's Dominican Republic. He came as a priest, and but saw the suffering that was inflicted upon Indian populations, and came to a point of solidarity with the Indian populations, started to write letters to Spain denouncing the crimes that were committed against the Indians, then wrote books on the suffering of the Indians, and very often Bartolomeo de las Casas is being mentioned as the first liberation theologian in Latin America. And that was right at 1500, right at the beginning of the history. And other people along the history of Latin America can be traced. On one occasion, for more than 100 years, there was a certain independent Indian state, the Guarani Republic, under the influence of Jesuits, which was located kind of in between what was the Portuguese Empire in Latin America and the Spanish Portuguese. So today's Paraguay, but then also part of today's Argentina, part of today's Brazil. And to a good extent here, there was a so-called independent republic of the Guaranis. The Jesuits had worked with the Indian populations, mainly the Guaranis, had brought them together in towns, and a remarkable civilization was developing. And it lasted for about 150 years. So it was successful in some way. But it was not definitely successful,
because Portuguese and Spaniards who fought against each other all the time along the so-called boundaries united to crush that experiment down and destroy it. Some of you might have seen the movie Mission, which portrays that part of the Latin American history. But nevertheless, it is one sign of a presence, of a Christian presence in solidarity with Indian populations and trying to foster the autonomy and independence of Indian populations. So liberation theology is, in some, you would say, is in a sense in that tradition, that prophetic tradition in Latin America, over against the prevailing system of legitimizing the conquest and exploitation of that continent with the Christian faith in the system of Christiandad. So rather than being a political ideological system in itself of which it is accused, it is rather a protest against a given system of identification of Christianity with a political and social and economic system. Well, I think this should be enough for the time being. I would like to invite you to make comments or ask any questions or also comments of critical nature, or you are welcome to do so.
The movie The Mission was powerful for those of us that saw it, and the tension between the evil was there and then the evils of the church too. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't help but leave the theater really very, very sad. Mm-hmm. Very sad. In fact, you know, there was a scene where one of the lead, the gentleman that was suffering from his guilt, where he was carrying his sins up the mountain to the Indian village initially, and then the family member that he had killed, his family, came and cut the burden from him. It was a powerful scene. And really, talk about forgiveness. We were talking about that earlier Bible study. It's just it's very moving.
Yeah, the movie Mission also is a very interesting and challenging movie in the sense that it does bring a little bit of today's questions into that period of history, in the sense that there's a kind of question what lying behind, what is the right strategy for Christian presence with suffering populations? Is it one of being present there and suffering with the population, even to the point of dying with those who are suffering, dying in solidarity? Or is it the role of trying to resist and take up on arms, a kind of questions that were risen already, what are the means, and trying to resist with armed means to against oppression and exploitation. So that kind of question, which is risen very much today, is in some sense was placed into that period of history, but which was, of course, very potentially very real at that time too.
See, either way, they both die.
Yes, yes. Well.
One fought a battle and the other one fought at the
king. Yes, well, that's one of the features that you can trace in Latin American history, that there is really the permanent defeat, even of attempts of liberation and so on. In fact, if I may call your attention to this book here, at this point, Open Veins of Latin America, by Eduardo Galeano. There are some copies at the bookstore over there. Eduardo Galeano is not a Christian. He's a journalist from Uruguay. He might be a Catholic, like all the population in Latin America is, but he's not a committed Christian, let's say so. He's a journalist and has written about the history of Latin America. But for those of you who are interested about the history of Latin America, this is a very good book. It's a shocking book. It does not follow the sequence of, let's say, dates and periods, but it brings out models of what it represented. Let's say in Bolivia, that mountain was, silver was discovered. What happened there? How was the system developed there to exploit silver? How it flourished and all the silver taken out? For a while it was seemed to be beautiful, but then the richness was out and it all crumbled down, and what lasted was the suffering and the poverty of the populations. So bringing up these economic cycles of Latin America with data and statistics and throughout, from the beginning up to about 20 years ago. The book is 17 years old already, but it still is a shocking eye-opener on Latin America. So, and the permanent defeat and so on is one of the features which will be found here, as the typical cycles. I didn't mention that economic cycles in gold, silver, sugar, cotton, cattle, coffee, rubber, and so on. Permanently you can find a certain cycle. Something is discovered, becomes important, and then falls down later on. And what lasts is then suffering or exploitation and defeat. Okay, there were other people.
You mentioned something that I hadn't ever heard of before, and that was how the financial benefits of all this exploitation did not stay in Spain and Portugal, went to Central Europe. Which countries in Central Europe, and how did that happen?
Well, that was to the Netherlands, England, to some extent also to the Fugger House in Germany, but Germany was not a united country at that time. These were the main places. Some went also to Rome, but especially Netherlands, England, and the Fugger House in Germany. And but of course, not all of the resources went there. A typical thing is that the centers of wealth in Latin America became not centers of investment, but centers of consumption, of luxury goods. For example, if there was silver discovered at a place in Bolivia, so for a certain moment it flourished and some money stayed in that area, a local elite developed. And what was that local elite supposed to do? And they were very much willing to do so. They would buy, let's say, luxurious goods from the metropolis, perhaps silk that had come to Europe from other parts of the globe would be one example, and they would bring even renowned artists from Europe to perform in these centers in Latin America. But no money really would be put into investment of a infrastructure, economic infrastructure. So when the silver would come to an end, there was no own production of other goods in that area, and so no income anymore. And the rich ones at the early years, they could go back to Portugal or Spain, or they perhaps could move to another place where some other rich would be found, but the local populations, Indians, blacks, and others, they would remain and were impoverished populations. And also Portugal and Spain developed very much, the royal house and so on, the court, they developed very much a pattern of more consumption than producing. The richness of Latin America was so great, the resources were so great, that Portugal and Spain kind of thought, well, that will never end. While your luck, we could say, your luck is that at the early stage of the colonization of the United States, New England states, such huge richness of gold and silver and so on was not discovered. So, and when that kind of natural resources was discovered, you were already an independent nation. So it stayed here and didn't go somewhere else. That's another important difference of the history of Latin America and your own history. Perhaps might add a third important difference is that in your case, usually families came, and families who came here to settle here and wanted to live here, were looking for religious freedom perhaps here, and they wanted to make a living here, so they looked upon this country, that's our home now, we are going to live here, and they were families. So that's the starting point. While Latin America, there was always during the colonization period a huge majority of male population. There were expeditions by white males. They wanted to get as much richness out as possible. If possible, they would move back to Portugal and Spain. But of course, along the years, a local population developed, a so-called elite over against Indian and black populations. And this local elite in Latin America was the force for the political independence in the beginning of the 18th century. But as I mentioned, they got the support of England over against Spain and Portugal, and that was the way they managed to declare the independence of these countries.
Was big power rivalries in the Britain and the Netherlands and Spain being the big powers, or I mean, was that part of it? Or?
Well, we do know there was a rivalry, and sometimes also they fought in different places, and there were the pirates. That was a system for a long period, of course. It was an official system linked with a crown. Britain would finance such expeditions to get now the products that others had taken out and so on. So of course there was rather wild competition going on too, yes. I think there were some other people.
To yes. What extent has Brazil been able to curtail the exploitation by foreign countries? I understand in the Amazon there has been a lot of exploitation, they're ruining
them. Yeah. Well, the question is about today's exploitation and the example of the Amazon region. I will be talking about today's economic problems a little bit more on Wednesday. If you don't mind, I would postpone it a little bit, and we would talk about the dependency theory, which is one element of used in liberation theology. I would be referring to that on Wednesday, also the international debt problem, and we can use the example of the Amazon region perhaps to illustrate today's problem. That would be good. Yes.
You said it, but I kind of lost it, but liberation theology, is that more of an outgrowth of the historical background that you've given us this morning, or is it a reaction to it?
Well, let me perhaps add it to serve as a kind of a bridge to tomorrow. I wanted to, at this first moment, bring about the history of Latin Americans and kind of say, well, liberation theology has to be seen in the context of this history. I don't want to say that that is the main or much less the source of liberation theology. I think there are other sources which are even more fundamental. Tomorrow I will be talking about base communities. So I think that's now the source within the church, the life of the church, development of the church, out of which liberation theology has grown. But one element within liberation theology is that contextual, in the sense also of historical, political, and social economic system, the contextual awareness, which is brought into liberation theology. And the point is that, that leads a little bit to the question of the context. The point is that if we come out of such a history of linkage between an economic system of exploitation and church and Christianity, which lasted for centuries, if we come out of that and we stick only to, let's say, the right doctrine or the right terminological theology, we are not addressing the problem of this continent. The problem is, what is Christianity if we have such a history? So we have to deal with that history and try to find out in the Bible, in the Gospel, in Jesus Christ, that is something else than what was the prevailing feature in our history. And so, as a kind of a contrast to the prevailing context, we have also to bring the contextual consideration into it. Otherwise, we would suddenly say, well, okay, Latin America has become a Christian continent. Today, we do the right to the theology, and we don't repent of the sins that were committed in the name of Christ in this continent. I think repentance is an important element of the liberation process. Yes?
If I understand you right, you're saying when the revolutions occurred, when independence was achieved, the economic relations weren't changed. But was nothing gained from the sort of political revolutions, or what role did the church play in that process?
Well, in fact, there were, at that time of the political independence, for example, in Mexico again, a presence of Christians too, and clergy. Father Hidalgo, for example, one of the main figures in Mexican independence. Kind of interesting that the hierarchy was Spanish. So, and had allegiance to Spain, while there was already a local clergy which felt then more nationalistic. So there was a certain, in some countries more than in others, there was a Christian presence in the process of political independence in Latin America. But
as a whole, it was a movement of what is called in Latin America the Criollo population. The Criollo population. These were the new elite which grew out during the centuries, and they called independence. Of course, it was much better for them after independency than before. The kind of taxes they had to pay to Portugal and Spain and so on fell off, so it wasn't an advancement. But for the majority of the population, it didn't change. Brazil, for example, at the time of independency, 2/3 of the population were black slaves. Just 1/3 of the population were non-slaves. One of the reasons out of which then the government tried to bring other European immigrants, for example, Germans, out of which I am a descendant, because they got a little bit scared that what it could mean if 2/3 of the population would, at a certain point, perhaps try to overcome that situation. So it was good to increase the white population to some extent. That was one of the reasons. The other one was that white farmers coming to Brazil in that case would be the small farmers, different from that system, and they would produce the goods now necessary for the internal market, food and so on. There was a certain necessity of an internal market, which also made it recommendable to bring European immigrants. And well, so I don't know whether I answered to some extent perhaps your question. One final.
Yes, you mentioned the struggle that we saw in as a sort of sub-theme in the movie Mission, of identifying with the poor and suffering the consequences for attempting the military solution or something like that. And it strikes me that Lutherans especially are very, very critical of liberation theology, but are not very critical, for instance, of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was involved in the same process.
Well, if you allow a personal testimony here, Dietrich Bonhoeffer has represented for me a kind of a bridge between our Lutheran tradition and the social concern which is typical in Latin America's liberation theology. I think he is a good example of a Christian who living in a situation of oppression and living out the faith means being prophetic and willing to suffer. And of course there are also differences. In Latin America we have a centuries long history of suffering, oppression and exploitation, and while Bonhoeffer was then at a certain period of the history with that diabolic Nazi regime, but it was in relation to that long history of Latin America was rather an episode, you could almost say, and we are in a much wider history, and especially also the responsibility of the Christian faith in terms of the history of Christiandad might be even bigger than the responsibility which Christians had in bringing about a system like the Nazi system in Germany. Well, I think our time is up. I would like to thank you for your questions and comments. And as I mentioned, tomorrow we would be talking about base communities. On Wednesday morning, world economy, and on Thursday more on the necessity of theology, why not only praxis, and then on Friday we'll be talking about the Christology, Jesus Christ in liberation theology, just to give you an idea about the themes.